I'm reminding you that our lessons that I am teaching on the flood, is their lessons are not my material. You know that. I'm using Walt Brown's book In the Beginning. I don't give credit for every statement because it takes me too long to do that. So I want you to know that. I also want you to know that the stuff that we're dealing with is really not settled science. I mean, it's not like it's the last word. I don't know if there ever will be a last word on this subject. You know, I think that that may not be possible. Also, and I tried to find out what other people say about Walt Brown's theories, and there's some out there that say things, and I'm reminded again that these guys have egos just like everybody else does. They got territories they want to defend, positions they've taken and want to defend. And they sometimes get kind of nasty, talk to each other. Well, he didn't give me up. So you get into that, so don't be too worried if you hear these kind of cross traffics. And sometimes they're dealing with just picky little things. But generally, I've not found people out there that are really attacking his basic premise, which is the underground water caverns that burst open. Answers in Genesis seem to support what they're doing, and they quote Brown, and others do too. So I just want to know that I'm not teaching you the Bible here. I'm teaching you a theory of the mechanisms of the flood that could be studied and some conclusions drawn because of what we can observe and by the normal process of the laws of science. Okay, so now I have questions too, but those I don't bring to you. Well, I do. I don't. If I don't, pardon?
Feel free, Larry can answer.
Yes, we'll depend on the front row to chime in here. So, and in fact, one of them I was going to do tonight, but I don't know understand it well enough. So, we'll wait until next week. And if I don't get my head around it by next week, we'll just skip it. But we'll get it figured out. So, I don't know whether my lesson is long or short today. I don't think it'll be long, so get through all these scribbles that are on the board. We're going to go over this material a little bit, not repetitively, but in our introduction so that these things that might not be totally fresh in your mind might come back. And having said it three times, we may be able to get it. This chart I've made available, not in color, and it's up here after class if you want a chart. Reason I want you to have this chart, it gives the basic framework of what happens in these four stages. There are verses in the Bible that we resort to, we check in on, and are basically our guide that we don't change. Genesis 7:11 says that in this second month of the 17th day of the month, on the same day, the point is that the fountains of the deep burst open and the floodgates of the sky were opened. Come on, mouse. Nope, not going to be obedient to that. No. And then we have Isaiah 24:19, which Mr. Brown does never cites this verse in his whole book, which I don't know why, but I've seen others do it. So I think probably it's a worthwhile consideration because it does describe the flood very accurately according to the way Mr. Brown lays it out. The earth is broken asunder. The earth is split through. The earth is shaken violently. The earth reels to and fro like a drunkard and totters like a shack, for its transgression is heavy upon it and will fall to rise, never rise again. This never rise again, I think it means to go back into the condition that it was before the flood. Now, that's not totally accurate either in terms of literal sense, because in the millennium it will be restored. So in terms of immediate context, it will not be restored in the context of the world as we know it. Okay, so I probably can't use that. So we have the fountains of the deep. We have the fountains of the deep open and the water chambers rupture with extreme amount of pressure, 62,000 pounds per square inch. And I read a little more about this pressure, and it is not enough to hurl things into space, spatial orbit around the sun. They have to take another kick. So I told you that he was doing some work on nuclear and other kinds of explosive energies that might have been at work, as well as just the water pressure to throw these into the air. We know they're out there. We know they're out there. We know they have to come from, you know, we talk about the meteorites and the comets are made out of water, and the moon was hit with water and debris, and we see all that scarring on the face. So we know it's happened. Now we just have to understand what was the mechanism that got it there. And once you don't know, it won't be just the water itself. I think the escape velocity, or what you call the escape velocity of the Earth, is something like, well, I've read 20 miles a second or 7 miles a second. And this 62 PSI will only generate a half mile per second, which is really pretty fast. It's really not all that faster than a high-powered rifle. So we have to have other mechanisms that we don't understand how that got up there. So in case you come across this, and someone might attack that point. So I thought I'd mention it. Hello? We have the fountains of the deep open. That's phase one. Comets, asteroids, meteorites, meteors. Can I say that word? Meteorites. That's spelled right, is it? That's not, it's got too many O's in it. Were launched. The mammoth were frozen. And we'll finish this later. That was where I got my problem. Because we're going to have to talk about the tilting of the Earth here. The tilting of the Earth's axis. And so that's kind of a problem I got to work on. He's got it figured out. I don't. So we have the continental shelves and the slopes forming. That's in part two. And then we have the, last week we talked about the Mid-Atlantic Ridge forming in the Atlantic Ocean. And we have the Pacific Basin do the opposite. It drops toward the center of the Earth. The Atlantic goes up away from the center of the Earth. We have the continental drift in phase three, when the mountains and the high plateaus form, ending in the compression event. We're going to go over that today. So if we look at it, in the process of this explosion, the continent appears to split in parts. And we have to remind ourselves, when something appears to split, it doesn't split at all. It doesn't need to. I mean, the Earth. It's just how it looks like it's doing. And that's what we're seeing here. The crack is on the surface of the Earth, not the whole Earth. And so when the water starts flooding, it looks like the continents are drifting. Well, they're not at this point. They're not drifting. They're just being flooded with water. And that makes the continents seem to move apart. Well, you know they don't move apart, actually. You're not here. So when it says they appear to split into parts, when the top 10 miles of the crust peeling back disintegrates and rains dirty water, mud, black ice, dry ice, which is carbon dioxide, and debris on Earth for 40 days, eventually providing, very important point here, eventually providing the miles, yes, miles, deep sediment on the Earth. The Earth shakes and vibrates and sets up wave actions, which we're going to talk about here, which provides a sedimentary layering by shifting the particles and animals, which are now dead, by the process of liquefaction. So these diagrams are just an idea of how it appears that the continents were drifting apart, when actually these are just waters that are blowing up and peeling back the surface Earth's crust. We talk about these rock fragments are being, and dust and water, are launched into space, are joined. These space pieces now are joined together by gravity, because gravity will affect those that are closest to it, and there's nothing close to it, so these things glum onto each other, and you get these unusual shaped rocks, because there's not enough gravity to pull them into a round circle. So you have the gravity join these gravity forming these meteorites that now orbit the sun, kind of following along the Earth, because that's where they came from. Some fall back to Earth as shooting stars, as solar dust. I was going to read about that. They said, we're walking on solar dust. I thought, how much? I read it somewhere. I couldn't find out where it was. We're walking solar dust. Meteorites fall back to Earth. In fact, did you bring your meteorite tonight, Mr. Fromm? Did you bring your meteorite? You guys, a little job, a little chore, a little assignment. Now, you found the meteorite in dirt, in undisturbed dirt? In sandstone. Isn't that impressive? Little, how big is it? Yeah. All right, probably iron and zinc, but what they say they all are. So, you have a treasure, I think, because how many of you have found a meteorite in your yard? One back there? No, he's just kidding. All right. All right. Well, you bring your next week, I'll bring the apostle next week, all right, because I forgot it. So these fell back to earth, and some of them get burned up in the atmosphere, never make it back to earth, but some of them fall to earth. And they're always found, by the way, in the upper layers of whatever this all gets done, on the upper layers of our dirt. They're not found deep, deep down in the strata. They're up there on the top, so they have come down later. So these this debris flew out of the earth, impacted the moon, a lot of it the water, giving the rough blotchy face, decreasing the orbit period to today's rate, which is a little bit short of 30 days, it's 29 and a half days. Sort of spoils the idea in the Bible where it says the moon and the earth were given cycles by which you could tell time. And they don't tell time very good now. You know, where 360 days works out great, but 365 days, you always have to have the leap year, and every 100 years you get a leap 100 years, and so on. In other words, I think there's been something happen in the cycling of the solar system that happened at the flood or the explosion of the earth. So in this process, the earth's rotation, losing 5% of its outer mass, speeds up. That's not the right word, is it? Speeds up, yeah, it is. I'm not a good speller, so Jim always comes and helps me out at the end of the class. Speeds up 5 1/4 rotations faster per year from 365 days. Because the Bible gives us the time of the flood in 365-day terms, or 30-day month terms. Continents will be built up with massive material from deeply, 10 miles, remember, deep eroded caverns, from these eroded caverns down here. Now our oceans here that eventually filled with rain later and runoff water. And by the way, this is a much better explanation for the floods, for the sediment on the earth than the canopy theory, which basically has water and the floods breaking up, rain, water, and the fountains of the deep breaking up, and the water swashing back and forth over the earth for 150 days. Now, the problem with that mechanism, there never is any new sediment drawn up. It's just the same stuff being recirculated. What we have with this model, we've got a hole. We've got 10 miles worth of sediment in the ocean that gets picked up and put on land. Most or a lot of it gets onto land. And I thought about it the way the water would squirt out, it would tend to come out this way, looking at it from here. So that water would tend to squirt out this way, and that would peel this land back. It would tend to always peel it in the way it's being eroded. And that's towards the shore. So you almost think that the dirt would be thrown more towards the continents than back into the ocean. So we have a better model here with that than I think with the canopy theory, where they just seem to move the water around with earthquakes, tsunamis, which we know are huge. But once you get a few layers or a few hundred feet or a mile worth of stuff that settled down, you're not going to get down and disturb that. In this scenario, there is a way to see that all of the earth's crust above the part that's been sediment now has been disturbed. And we're talking at least 2 miles and more that's been disturbed. You know, more than just the running water over the top of it. Now, the Atlantic split, the removal of the overburden explosions, raised the Atlantic floor 10 miles and remaining subterranean water acted as grease. This movement assisted by the Pacific Basin, we don't see it here, dropping on the other side as Atlantic rises, making the continent slide abruptly, stopping, forms the raised continental surfaces. The high mountains and the high plateaus of the Colorado Plateau at 6,000 feet, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and the high Tibetan Plain, which is at 16,000 feet. I'll give you some pictures of where all this lies. So here we have the most simplest diagram. Earth crust that gets eroded, the 3/4 mile thickness that gets mostly emptied. You have a Mohawk depth, that is the part of the earth that does not get disturbed. You might call it the original earth. So this is where it blows up, it gets scattered one way or the other, probably a little more that way than that way. Well, this would be towards Europe, and this would be towards looking at the Atlantic. There's all, same thing would have happened in the Pacific Ocean, not quite the same. But this would have gone through the Americas, and this would have gone to the European coast, it would have been peeling it back and depositing these deposits. Then we have the last phase of our discussion here is the continental shift. It's not a drift, it's swifter, 45 miles an hour. It seems kind of fast for dirt to move. How does it even get started that quickly? This question has come to my mind, but we don't deal with these kind of forces in our, nobody deals with these kind of forces in our existence. No engineer does. No engineer does. So I'm sure you can figure it out mathematically, and these guys do that, and so these are the things he comes up with. All right, so you have this tilting of the earth. I show that Mojo is a tilting. It really doesn't tilt because it stays flat. But this tilts, it starts floating, and we have the continental shift. And then we have the piling on of sediment on top of this, which gives us to the end of the flooding stage. So we have on the west east coast, it slides at 45 miles an hour for as much as 200 miles. We find that these lines are basically vertical, the north and south, not perfectly. But we see a skip here, then we pick it up again, the mountain range up here in that, what is that, Nova Scotia? Newfoundland. Okay. So we have bunching, I mean the ground gets bunched. As you go from the Mississippi River and go west, you can watch your altimeter go up. We're at 1,200 feet here at the airport. And where I came from in New York County, Hamilton County, we're at 1,500 feet. And you keep on going to the west part of the state, now we're at 1,800 feet, it just slowly goes up. In fact, your car will do better gas mileage coming this way than going that way. You don't notice it, but it is there. You are going uphill. So we have this going uphill. I made a mark at 600 feet, sort of the Great Lakes are like at 500 feet, so 600 feet above sea level. And then we have, you know, the dirt obviously is above sea level. It would be, you know, like New Orleans. So the Appalachian Range with the individual mountains were averaged around 3,000 feet, the highest of the group, Mount Mitchell in North Carolina, 6,600 feet, which is the highest point in the United States east of the Mississippi River. So this is kind of a minor wrinkle, you know, a minor wrinkle compared to what we have on the West Coast. On the West Coast, we have the bunching, again, from 1,800 up to 14,000. Those are the, what they call the Ivy League Range and San Juan Mountain Range, south of Denver, southeast, southwest of Denver. Again, you see this more or less east and west range of mountains that would fit this crunching effect. Then we have this land, of course, moving this way, coming around this side. We have this crunch zone called the Ring of Fire. And this, the distance between here is a lot less than this is shown because we're shown around map on a flat plane, so that way it gives you a distortion here at the bottom, because here's Antarctica, and South America and Antarctica are really close together. Anyway, you have the ring, more of a ring than this looks to be a ring. So we have the crunch zone, Ring of Fire, the plate that is out of equilibrium since most of the deceleration occurred here. In other words, this land moves this way, this land moves this way, and you see today's movement of these continents are still in process. If you want to study this real carefully, you won't, but this shows a length of movement in a year. That length of line on this map would show 5 centimeters. 5 centimeters would be about an inch, right? 2.4 centimeters an inch, so you'd have about less than an inch. You'd have a year. So if the long line here is longer than an inch, then it's moving more than an inch a year. But look which way these guys are all moving, except for anomaly here or there, but they're mostly moving in this direction, which is the direction that they originally came from. And these are mostly moving in the easterly direction, the direction which the continental plates really shifted. And you get down here, nothing much happening. You get to the top, not much is happening. All right, so that gives you a little bit of an argument. You see the plate lines that exist. And of course, this one that's unstable. Right now, where all the volcanoes go, and because of the shifting, it continues to go on. The pressure that goes on in the under the ground magma pressure makes those volcanoes erupt. I'll try to do one on volcanoes. I got 3 weeks. I'm trying to pick up some things that might be of most interest. So here's our ring of fire. We have deep trenches in the Marianas Trench. The deepest is 35,000 feet. That puts it a mile deeper than Everest is high. Like I said, the Pacific Ocean fell down, and the Atlantic Ocean rose up. And there's a reason for this, if I get it figured out. You know, it seems like the Earth is 7,000 miles in diameter. It's kind of hard to you punch one side, you know, 10,000 feet, that it's going to show up on the other side. You know, that's sort of like, how do you do that? But there's some reason why that actually does happen. Okay, the Challenger cliff is really quite deep. Of course, this is exaggerated. Horizontal, vertical is exaggerated, or vertical is exaggerated, but in it's a deep abyss. Don't they make movies about that? Isn't it called The Abyss? Who is that? What's her name? One I don't like, don't mention her name. Okay, so we have the sediments and fossils, which will generate also the oil and the coal. Some asked about that. This comes in this lesson, it comes in our study today. We have part one, the action during the flooding, which is the water rises. Part two, we have the compression during the end of the flooding stage. It only rained 40 days only, you know, but this whole period of time is actually 150 days. So during this time, we have this, at the end of the day, we probably have the, at the end of this time, we have the compression event, so we have the pushing together. And then we have the final stage, the erosion stage, or runoff stage, that would do another job on the face of the earth. So those are the three stages that I have here on the board. So first of all, the sedimentary stage. It's hard to think about this. It really is, because Northern Nebraska Capitol wasn't there, but I thought it was cute. And it wasn't quite that tall. But I'm just thinking we're looking at it, we're from in the middle of the Plain States. So that's where we are. We would see these sediments layered like this, more or less, first stage horizontally, laid down horizontally. If there were mountains, they were shallow mountains, and they would have probably gone up and around them and so forth, you know. So we basically want to think about them as flat level spaces or layers. We will find in the end that they will be fish trapped, dead fish trapped in there. We call those fossils. So the geology, now this is the evolutionary answer here. The geologic column supposes that the layering was similar to the rate today of this sedimentation, which would require millions of years to achieve small depths. Present rate is what, one millimeter a year. The question is, how could fish laying on sediment wait for millions of years, or even 1,000 years, or even 2 years, to cover it up to make a fossil? But in their system, that's what's happened. They've laid there, and then the sediment's laid over them, and then pretty soon they got those, you know, fossils aren't made that way. So this whole idea is bogus. Now there is a graduation of animal life in this, but there's a different reason for that. So we have sedimentary rock during this period in depths of miles. I tried real hard to find out how deep they think it really was, or how the deepest was, but in my mind it seems like as much as 5 miles, but I know for sure 2 and deeper. Now that is before there was a runoff and the erosion stage. Okay. All right, now we're going to talk about liquefaction. I talked to you last week about drowning in quicksand. It's pretty hard to do because sand and water, it has more buoyancy than water does. So if you lay still, get your nose up, you probably won't go down. And if you want to get over to the edge, you probably should do it very carefully, you know, very gently and very slowly. Because as soon as you start moving, then that separates water, separates from the sand, you seem to tend to sink again. All right, so liquefaction, if I don't say it right, that's what I'm trying to say, is what we're going to look at tonight. And we talk about these layers that occur in this. Let's see how we go here. How this works. Again, this is kind of like our minds don't think about this kind of thing. Or do we think that things happen as fast as it looks like it does? These are waves. This is not my drawing. We have a peak of a wave. We have a lower wave. Now we have high pressure here, low pressure here, right? And these things can be, you know, a matter of feet apart. In big waters, they could be, you know, 50 feet apart. So we have this high pressure movement that and it works on the bottom of the waterbed. And maybe it isn't so much the bottom of the waterbed, but in the column of material with water in it, like our quicksand. So we have this column of material that's mixed with water, and this water, if it comes in from the bottom, why, by the way, that's what makes quicksand, that's what makes sand quick. Water comes from the bottom, it tends to start floating these little particles up. And those particles float up, obviously you can't stand on them. They get loose. So that's what happens with the water when you come across quicksand in the Platte River. It's because you stepped onto a spring that feeds underneath a pile of sand. That's the process that we're going to think about. So, but what does the cycling occur here? And that's what we have. We've got cycles, high pressure, low pressure, high pressure. A wave cycle begins on the left, bringing water being forced down into the seafloor, being pushed down. As the wave trough approaches, that compressed water is released. Pressure is released, so it comes up. The water then flows up through the seafloor, lifting the sediments, starting at the top of the sedimentary column. It drags stuff up with it. During liquefaction, denser particles sink, and lighter particles and dead organisms, soon to become fossils, float up until liquefaction lens is encountered. So it floats up until it gets here. Well, then if it gets to this point, somehow works itself up to that point, let's say this is our little fossil, it's going to stay there. And as time goes on, more and more are going to stay there. Because now all of a sudden we're getting the ceiling is going to be sealed off from this water going through. It's going to be difficult for water to pass through it. So we're starting to, especially with coal, we're starting to get a layer of debris that is starting to somewhat float in this cavern on the ceiling of this, they call it water lens. So lenses from water form along nearly horizontal paths in the sediment, if the sediments below the horizontal paths are more permeable than those above. In other words, water can't go up, but it can come from the bottom, and so it gets trapped here. All right. Sedimentary particles and dead organisms buried in the sediments were sorted by weight and resorted into vast thin layers. Just kind of get the idea. I mean, don't have to explain it back to me. Sort of get the idea. Now, this is what it looks like when it's done, and all the water has been removed from it, or most of the water has been removed from it. We have these rocks. In fact, if you have Windows 7, isn't this one of the pictures you get when you open your screen? Comes from this, wherever it is, I suppose in Utah, or Arizona probably. But we have all these sedimentary layers. I'm always standing with somebody. And obviously, when you go to a river where there's a little waterfall, we'll see these kind of ledges, and we see right away there's sedimentary rocks. And we say, oh, isn't that beautiful, and don't think anything of it. I would say from now on, whenever you're going to go to the mountains, you're going to be looking at stuff you've never looked at before. And you'll enjoy seeing what you see. Oh, there, look, that's, you know. So you see, this is not just the way God made it. I understand what I'm saying here. It's not the way God made it. This is what happened as a result of the judgment. And this next week I wrote about that. You know, we see the world as God has judged it, not as God made it. So we tell our kids how God made it that way, that's fine. But we understand what we mean by that, because it was made that way, yes, but it's really a result of a destructive flood judgment. Okay, so the water lens collects fossil materials. If water flowed more easily up through the sedimentary rock, then the layer above it, that came up easy here, stopped here, a lens of water accumulated between them. Multiple lenses could form simultaneously, one a short distance above the other. Water in these near horizontal lenses always flow uphill. Now here's an example of water flowing uphill. Did you know water flowed uphill? You might not think about it, but it does. If you have a bucket full of water and you put rock in it, what will the water do? It goes up. All right, that's the principle here. So water goes up if there's something heavier to displace it at the bottom. So that's what's happening here. So water, these lenses tend to carry their debris up because this down here is heavier than this layer in here. So it tends to go uphill. All right, water's buoyant force is only about half that of the liquefied, that's a different word, sediment. So a water lens was always able to lift dead organisms into the denser sedimentary layer directly above the lens in each geological region. Organisms with smaller size, shape, density, usually members of the same species, often end up in the same lens because it's the weight, the density is what makes them, you know, be a family, so they stay together. And they're sorted by weight and volume. They were swept by currents, sometimes for many miles along nearly horizontal channels. Now these lenses apparently get big because we have layers of coal that actually used to be a lens that collapsed the last time it happened, and there it stuck. Coal and oil. So we talk about coal now. Vegetation lifted by liquefaction into water lenses spread out and formed a buoyant mat pressed up against the lens's roof. This is the roof. Vegetation mat composed of thin, flat, relatively impermeable sheets. You know, they get impermeable after a while, such as intertwined leaves, ferns, grass, wood fragments could not push through that roof, so it stays put there, and then it starts gathering more and more. These mats also prevented sedimentary grains in the roof from falling through the floor because they're stuck above it. Each vegetation mat acted as a check valve to let it go through it. That is, during the portion of the wave cycle when the water flowed upward, the mat reduced the flow upward through the lens roof so that the lens volume grew. Lens got bigger, more stuff in it. During the other half of the wave cycle, when the water flowed downward, the low wave cycle, the mat was pushed away from the roof, lowered it, allowing new water to enter the lens. Therefore, water lenses with vegetation mats thickened and expanded during the flood. Now, these get to be big. Vegetation mats became today's old coal seams, some of which can be traced over 100,000 square miles. So we don't want to think of these little lenses. So just doing this as an example to have you understand it. When liquefaction lenses slowly collapsed, for the last time, plants and small animals were trapped. Now, they weren't alive. Flattened and preserved between the lens roof and floor. Fossils sandwiched between thin layers were often spread over wide surfaces, which geologists call a horizon. Probably a different color of sediment. Now, evolutionary ideas. Thousands of years later, these horizons gave some investigators the false impression that these animals and plants died long after layers below were deposited and long before layers above were deposited. A layer with many fossils covering a vast area was misinterpreted as an extinction event or a boundary between geological periods. And of course, they misunderstood because they don't accept the flood and the wave actions of the flood and all that. Barbs, that's a new word for me, are extremely thin, typically 1 millimeter thick, which evolutionists claim are laid down annually in lakes. By counting barbs, evolutionists believe that time can be measured. You can see how they do this. In the Green River Formation, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, I wanted to go there last year, we didn't get there. I'll have to go back. A classic barb region contains millions of flattened, paper-thin, fossilized fish, and I was going to bring one for you today, and I left it home just like you forgot your rock. Obviously, burial was sudden. Fish lying on the bottom of the lake for years would decay or disintegrate long before enough barbs could bury them. Besides, dead fish float, deteriorate, and sink. Most fish fossilized and barbs show exquisite detail and are pressed to the thinnest of a piece of paper as if they had been compressed in a collapsing liquefaction lens, and that's what happened. Also, barbs are too uniform, show almost no erosion. They are deposited over wide areas where streams enter lakes where most lake deposits occur. Liquefaction best explains these barbs.
VARS. VARS. You have a leaf here, actually, was a tough leaf. I mean, it's hard to even imagine that leaf would stand, you know, this wave action for very long, but it did, apparently, because it was setting on end, and the wave action perhaps was this way, so it didn't disintegrate, but we have that guy, you know, over millions and millions of years living through that to be built, you know. It doesn't make sense. Here's an interesting, maybe this one of the famous fossils where one fish is eating another one. At that moment, it was smashed, caught. Okay. Now, this is an interesting little, you know, I took this off the website and said these are the winter deposits, here are the dark ones, and the summer deposits are light. Now, that makes totally sense. You do wear light in the summer and dark in the winter, don't you? So that's what the deposits would be. Why else would they say that? So an attempt to explain different coloring has been laid down at different times of the year. Guesswork, sheer guesswork. Where is the debris from normal seasonal changes? I got more debris in my yard than this thing shows. So it just couldn't have happened over thousands of years. It happened to happen in a very short time. Because there'd be dirt in there. What you find in there are fossils. And that would make sense because they were in the water. Now, here's an interesting one. Here's a fossil in sedimentation record. Dragonfly with this delicate 1.5 foot long wing. Double that and you got a dragonfly that's 3 foot in wingspan. Have you seen one like that? So these animals before the flood were probably a lot bigger than what we see today. They were rapidly buried evenly to preserve its detail. Imagine the size of the entire dragonfly. So we see the detail in this, and it would have to happen quickly because it would lay there for a couple of days. This already would be decomposing. All right, so we have sedimentary phase one, reprise. Go through this. Water covers all the early earth, not nearly, all the early earth. The ark will land in the next phase, perhaps at the end of the continental shift phase, raising the mid-eastern mountain range of the Ararats to as high as 17,000 feet. The Ararat range is right in through here. Okay, now that's this one here. That's our little sedimentation cycle. Mountain range, but you know where that is. One more thing about this is the Buckle Mountains. Textbook museums frequently refer to some uplifting force that formed mountains. Can you see that an uplifting force by itself would not produce this pattern? Horizontal compression was needed to buckle these sedimentary layers near the Sullivan River in southern British Columbia, Canada. These layers must have been soft, like wet sand, and at the time of the compression. Today's surface rocks are brittle, and they would never fold like that. Has anybody seen these? I've not. You know, I barely ever go to Canada. Okay, now the shifting continents. Boy, it's hard to draw. Because when you go from here to here, the east coast to the west coast, we're talking about 3,000 miles. Is that right? About 3,000 miles. And we're talking the Colorado Mountains at 14,000 feet. We're less than 3 miles high. So when I would draw a 14,000 foot peak on a 3,000 mile sheet of paper, you can already see it. You see, I mean, so we don't think about the mountains as being so big in compared to the stretch. So we're talking about a lot of room here to stretch, to push them up a little bit, really, in a sense. It's not like they're pushed up for 50 miles or 100 miles or 1,000 miles. They're just 3 miles. And Everett said, what, 29,000 feet? So it's barely 5 miles, not even 5 miles, a little over 5 miles. So it's hard to draw this so that you get the right impression. So bear with me with this being a schematic. We have the flood waters before subsidence. In other words, the earth was covered with water. And that's when the layers were laid down. There were some mountains. We don't know how high they were. Probably for beauty, you know, not just big open flat prairie spaces. So we had the layering here. Then we had the steps when the continents collide or shift. We have the rocks do that kind of thing. When the continent slides, we have the, you think like a deck of cards. that you push on the top, some on the bottom are going to stay put, and some on the top are going to slide over. You're going to have that kind of action as well. So it doesn't all move as a group. It's going to move in sections. Wherever the break loose point is, it's going to move. We don't know how many of those were, because we have a lot of layers here that were laid down, lots of layers. Okay, so we have this flood waters before subsidence. The slipping plates, some are left behind, others travel to the end and are folded. I'd say few travel to the end or folded, or they're shifted, like I said, move 200 miles. Maybe they all move down 200 miles, so whatever, they got bunched up at the end. So we have this decline away to the east coast. So now the erosion phase. Now we've got our crunch. We've got the Rocky Mountains pushed up. There's a breaking force that stopped them. It ran out of water, ran out of grease, so it stopped. But we have the gravitation force, because it's a little bit on an angle, and it's pushing down. So the gravitational force, so that caused the Appalachian, and we have this slow increase here towards the Rocky Mountains, and you've been through the Rocky Mountains, you go up there and you have open, you got the Colorado Plateau, and you go to some more mountains, you got the Sierras, and you know, you get into the West Coast, you got even the highest mountain in the United States is what, in Washington? So what we're talking about, major forms, so the Rocky Mountains still are those. I showed them just as one range, which they're really more than that. So the water, when this gets pushed up, they could well have been pushed above the water level. And Mr. Brown thinks that perhaps when that happened is when Noah's Ark landed. Not here, but in Ararat. So there it parks, because he's in the Ark another 150 days. I think that's what he was waiting there. So what's he waiting for? Well, for the water to run away. Well, it probably is kind of nice to get your feet on terra firma, so the rock doesn't keep, boat doesn't keep rocking all the time. They've been doing that for 250 days. So maybe the Lord put the ark on a firm foundation and then waited for the water to subside. So in our country here, we have, you know, either the water goes in the Pacific Ocean or it comes down to the Mississippi River Delta or basin, or pours into the Atlantic Ocean, which just goes into the Atlantic Ocean. So these, like a lot of water, now is going to take off a lot of the sediment, which is what I couldn't show. Remember, we're talking about a lot of sediment here, been taken off and drug away, washed away. So we have now eroded depths. I'm going to say 2 miles. I don't know what the depths are. You say, well, how much was it here? I don't know that anybody would know that. So you just know that there was a lot piled on and a lot of it got washed off. You go to the Platte River, you see the bluffs, you go to Cedar Bluffs, the Platte River where it got washed out, you know that the land was higher. And then the water train that, or water, the river, like on the Platte River, had to be, how long is it from Cedar Bluffs side to side? It's got to be a couple mile. You know, now you got a little creek going down there, half mile wide, an inch deep or something like that. So, you know, but in the flood runoff, that was a huge river. And probably really, really big, and got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And it would take years for this to happen, because remember, we're going to have the ice age going to kick in here, and it's going to be melting, and it's going to bring water down from the north. So we have a lot of water action on this planet. So we erode our depths up to 2 miles, probably more, and then we get to what we call our configuration as we know it today. And again, it's basically sea. See, these are contours as you go up, and this is about 1,800 feet right here, and it's pretty much north and south. And you see the Rocky Mountains run pretty well to north and south. The Sierras, so forth, pretty much the Appalachian, a little bit of an angle. But, you know, it's within range to think they pushed it like this. It was pushed like that. I just thought interesting, look at the international river basins we have. Mississippi is huge. You see the continent, you know, the two we're looking at. So here's the Mississippi drains this section. So even in the Middle East or in the, you know, Russian area, you have a lot of these rivers. And these other areas that don't show major water rivers, they apparently don't have a lot of rainfall, or the ground is very sandy and doesn't actually produce that much rainfall. So these are the major river basins of the world, and they would all have been formed after the flood. And some of them didn't really actually drain out. We still have the Great Lakes up here and other places in the world where we have these lakes that are just natural lakes. Now, the Great Lakes actually drain out now, but probably at some time there were other lakes. In fact, when you get to our Grand Canyon formation, We're going to talk about a couple of lakes that were in that Colorado High Plateau that breached, that actually formed the Grand Canyon. So there were other lakes that we don't know about anymore because they finally just breached and ran out. Just the issue of liquefaction is just from an engineering standpoint. In architecture, we did, you always had to design buildings to stand on on ground that they wouldn't tip over. An important issue with buildings. We understand from earthquakes, there are dangers, when these unconsolidated sediments, which is unconsolidated, would be like not rock material, like we have here. I don't know if there's a building built in Lincoln that's built on rock. You'll find a rock here once in a while. It's not built on rock, they're built on dirt. You know, holds about 3,000 pounds per square foot. But let's say that dirt gets, soaked with water, such as sand and mud and artificial fill, generally magnified ground shaking during an earthquake. So we're going to have this kind of happen. All this stuff, water gets into this loose material here, loosens up the material and starts wanting to float. And we have the liquefaction. And we have dangers of earthquakes of ruining buildings. Buildings constructed on sandy soil prone to water saturation have the general potential for complete destruction because water saturated sandy soil is subject to the phenomenon called liquefaction. So a lot of times when you have that kind of soil, you drive piles. You build the building on piling. Gives you a little bit more protection. And if you don't do that, this is what happens in earthquakes. This is what happened. They didn't fall over because the earth was shaking like this. They fell over because the foundations gave way. The soil liquefied in a sense. It just became fluid. In fact, I saw there's a video on, you know, just a lot of stuff on YouTube that's a lot of fun to watch. And there was this guy doing a dance on liquefied water. The top had a crust on it. He was dancing on it. We just like walking in water. Well, underneath that, there was this kind of condition. So it's really not that hard to reproduce or to see. So anyway, during earthquakes, the earth gets shook, the water gets shook, and it gets squirted and squeezed up in these and loosens the soil. The water, you know, makes the stable ground unstable, and the footings lose their viability, and buildings tip over. And we have these in fields, so that are, I don't know where these all come from. This one happens to be from Christ Church, that is in New Zealand. Okay. Well, anyway, this is a field. You see, it's a minor one, but you know the same thing has happened. Water has come up, and if you'd walk on this before, you know, like here, you'd walk on, you'd probably sink to your knee because it was just like quicksand. So, a sand volcano after Christ Church earthquake, large tracts of silty low-lying land compounded the effects of Saturday's earthquake. I'm reading from an article in Canterbury, as the whole streets were transformed to a huge land of sludge. All right, so we understand that it's not an unusual phenomenon. We're just saying that that kind of stuff happened during the flood. We have the sandy layer. Occasionally you have this, particularly like we have salt, will sit under the sandy layer, and for some reason or other the crack forms, or there's pressure with salt wants to rise, and it finds its way up, and pretty soon you've got a salt dome. Or something else like a mound. I'll show you one that we saw in the Yellowstone that Larry pointed out to me. It happened to be a limestone one, but the same principle would be in effect. So here, it says, I'm standing. That's not me. It's the guy that's writing this. Liquefaction plume. 100 of these plumes are found in Kodachrome Basin State Reserve in southern, south central Utah, 10 miles east of Bryce Canyon National Park. This man is standing at the bottom of the plume. See how small he is compared to this. Now, there used to be dirt up to here. This has all been washed away. And this is what's left. Another one. Oh, I have another one. I think I didn't bring another one. All right. Another thing. This is the Grand Canyon. This is the Precambrian. Precambrian rock means the rock that was there from the beginning. It was not disturbed during the flood. Supposed to be. So we have these at an angle and these that are laying flat. So we have this. These last two things almost happened like almost kind of happened together. Because after it tilted, then there's still some more stratification and sedimentation on top of it. And some more liquefaction going on. And you see this here. This is the tilting part. And then after it was done tilting, there's some more sediment got layered on top of it. And then maybe some more pushing. You know, it's just hard to describe how these things all work. So So here's the Colorado River at the bottom. If you go to the Colorado River, you'll see the Precambrian. And then the interesting point here is they call this the anomaly, anyway, because it doesn't fit this. But we have this quartzite block here, next picture, is embedded in the side of this cliff, what's left of it. Apparently, this quartzite block was transported in a sliding sedimentary slurry above the Cambrian, Precambrian interface, which I showed you, during the compression event. This is the compression event. Peak deceleration, slowing down, occurred in the layers below the sliding slurry. So this rock came from on top, slid down. This included the quartzite layer. The sudden deceleration and compression tipped those layers up, allowing them to be beveled off by the overriding layer. So you see this got buried down here, like it slid down. And then these, as they were piled on top of it, kind of went around it and finally went over it. So this was piled in there in the later sedimentary layering. And then we have all the Grand Canyon layer on top of that. So a transported block, a very large block made of hard, dense material called quartzite, lifted hundreds of feet, transported horizontally, deposited on layers which at the time were soft mud. At the time, the other mud layers then blanketed the rock. Notice how the layers were deformed below the right there corner and above the left corner. The easiest way to lift and transport a heavy rock is a liquefied and therefore very buoyant sand mud water mixture. You know, rock and water is a lot lighter than rock, you know, in the open. So it gets picked up and gets moved. Okay. Now, another little joy we had last year. We did the Grand Canyon tour last year, and we're doing this for this reason. We came across this prize. Never heard of the Grand Staircase. You guys know about the Grand Staircase? Grand Staircase, anybody? Anybody? Southern Utah. At least one guy knows about the staircase. Another one? Well, you lived there. That doesn't count. But the staircase is wonderful. And the guy said, we stopped at one of these visitor stations. And he said, yeah, well, this is the Grand Staircase up there. And I said, what's that? And I looked up there, and sure enough, there were all these rocks. You know, we were down here somewhere. We could look up and see the Grand Staircase. Well, I'll show you a number of pictures. But these are actually rocks, stratifications that end up dying out. What happened to them? Well, it got eroded. That much, I'm just saying an example, I'm just taking this line and bringing it up. That's 2 miles. You look on the edge over here, you can see that. That's 2 miles worth of erosion. 2 miles that eroded, and we're at a high elevation here. So this gets, we're getting very close to the Grand Canyon here. So we're going to talk about that next week, what else happened there, because there was uplifts besides just this folding here. I will get into that. But it's interesting how much water or how much soil was eroded from the Grand Staircase. Now again, this would have been leveled straight out here. Just draw this straight out. Look at all these layers. Here's Highway 89. 89 takes you into Flagstaff, doesn't it? And this goes back up to Page, Arizona. There we go. Where the dam is. All right. So this is interesting. You get all these formations, and I love these guys talking about how this all formed, and they don't know anything about it. Here again, you have this idea how this was tipped, and after it was tipped, maybe it was washed off first, and then it was tipped. We don't know what the sequence was. But it's a large area. This is that upper plateau, and we're going to show next week that a lot of this was the lake, the upper Colorado plateau. That thing I just showed you be right about in here. Another layer. This is laying horizontally with these all eroded. Here's the Grand Canyon, which looks to be at the bottom of the hill, but actually the Grand Canyon runs through a hill. Another phenomenon that's unusual. I mean, it cuts through the top of a hill. You usually think of it goes down through a valley, but it cuts to the top of the hill. Again, it had to be cut and then lifted or something like that. There's Larry. All right, we have a limestone bubble that came up, and that's what it says here, the Soda de Butte. What is it? Soda Butte. And this is calcium carbonate. It's limestone bubbled up, and it comes up from underneath. I just thought it was kind of interesting. We've seen one of those that was like that, and then everything's been washed away from it. Or it could have formed after. Let me see, I don't know for sure. Good job. 3 minutes short. If I can help you with anything, let me know. Try me.
I just have a thought. You have ruined a lot of suspenseful moments of movies where you can't drown in a can't go under.
That's tough, isn't it? That is tough. You still can get hurt falling off a cliff. Just don't forget that. Yes.
Only if you fall down.
Yeah. I said you fall off the cliff. Jim. Backing up, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I would suppose
it would be, you have another deal like the Devil's Tower in Wyoming. They don't know how that's formed, but it's obviously forced up. What do you call these little columns that look like spaghetti in a bundle? And then they stuck together, and that's how it's kind of like fluted, but they're actually like prisms with, many sides, and they're just sticking together. So the theory was that it was pushed up, like lava, and then formed that way, and then the dirt that was around it washed away. That's probably one theory. Yeah, right. What you have now, I think, you should have tools in your mind that could start analyzing what you see. And this thing at Ashfall in Royal Nebraska, some have asked me, well, was that so-and-so, was that after the flood, before the flood? I was so convinced before, but I'm not sure. I got to think about that a little bit, because just when did that work? And I haven't had time to think about a lot. But I think you have the tools now which you can look critically at things, and when you see something tipped, it was during the compression stage. Or we haven't talked about the uplift yet. So they'll give you two choices here. So you'll have tools. I think when you look at these, if you go to Southeast Utah and you see all these spires, or if you go to Cappadocia in Turkey, you'll see all these columns that are standing up there with a little red rock on the top of another one. They stand so perfectly, and they say the wind blew all that away. I said, I don't think so, ma'am. I think it was water. And you're in the country of the air rats, so. So anyway, you have tools, I think, for which you can analyze critically what you're looking at. Steve? Sure did. Yep. And the layering, the sedimentation was, that was, took care of a lot of the arguments. So, interesting. The Lord puts out certain kind of things that fill the air real quickly.
And if there is a video, it may be in there. I have a personal on that.
Yeah, and how these trees, when they float for a while, they'll end up standing back up again with the roots down, and then they'll stand through layers of sediment. I think it's fun. I think I'm going to go on the road.
Yeah, let's show how we're going.
Yeah. The trouble is somebody's already done it. That's the problem,
That reminds me, there's several books out there called that roadside theology.
Oh, yeah. They would point out stuff like
what? Yeah, the yellow little book.
Is it from a creationist point of view?
No.
Okay.
No, she read them.
Yeah, well, it'll help immensely if you can read something from a creationist point of view. Because you've got to, first of all, decide, now, is that really true? Because you start out with a guy that doesn't believe in the flood, and you're going to go out and look at all the evidence of the flood. It's kind of hard to read that. You'd have to just sort it all out. So they're like the diameter of the earth and the thickness of sediment, those are measurable, provable, verifiable figures, so you can trust them on that. But when it comes to this philosophy stuff, how did this get here? And there's more and more of that kind of material out there. I wish it was all really, really good. I think there
are, in any case, like the guy that's trying to predict the return of the Lord, there's always those kooks out there that are trying to make a point proving the Bible right by making a mistake. And that's worse. You know, just leave it alone. We don't need it to prove anything. We just need it to understand how God has done it, and we're not going out showing anybody how wrong they are because they are wrong. We just, we do it for ourselves mostly.
Speaking of analyzing what you see, it's just when our kids were done and conducting, you go I-70 between Kansas City and St. Louis quite a few times, and just at the Missouri River down by the road court, where you come at the top of the hill, and you see clear across to the other side of that you call it basin or valley, and then a little river in the middle. You say, how could anybody think that river did all that?
Right.
No matter how much. It's obvious, you sit there and kind of visualize a huge cascade of water coming down there and sweeping that whole thing out, and the river just a trickle left over.
Yep.
But you can just really get the idea when you look across the whole thing.
Yeah. When you get used to looking at the world through a flood lens, you'll see stuff you just never thought you'd see. It's not just beauty anymore. It's a, wow, look at that. I wonder what happened here.
Well, look at the flat roof of the valley.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
The sand systems are not there, and you've got pretty big rocks in there.
And fossils? Mm-hmm. Well, Merlin Stewart said he dug a fossil out of his well when they dug it. Yeah, I don't know how many hundred feet it was, came out with the sand.
Right, so it's pretty dark in Peru, Bolivia. Some people want to say that was formed by a volcano, and they can't because there's no evidence of it. And it could mean maybe that was
lifted.
Material. That's number one. Number two is it 12,000 feet, and kind of conforms to what you were pointing out on southwestern Colorado and southeastern Utah, you know, that plateau is UCLA. There's still a lake down
at 10,000 feet.
12,000
feet. Big lake.
Big lake.
Yeah. I think that's wonderful. Anyway, the book that I said earlier was called The Fingerprints of God deals with some of this stuff from an unbeliever's point of view, but he's trying, we just had a lot of glacier melt here. That's how he deals with it. But I mean, what he's reporting is probably what's out there. And so it's interesting when you read it with the mind again of the creation of the flood theology, it just makes a lot of sense. It opens up some questions that we probably haven't considered before. So, all right. Don't forget your sheet if you all want, and I'll pray and you can go. Lord, thank you for the evening, for the joy we have knowing you, and for the time we have studying your creation. And Lord, even this awesome event, the flood, Lord, we really do not understand how big event it was. And that's part of the problem we have with this whole thing, is that we tend to think in too small a terms. The Lord, you destroy the earth in a sense that so that it would never rise again. That's a destruction that's beyond our ability to comprehend. So Lord, thank you for the men that have worked on these projects and have helped us understand things from a scientific point of view, from a physical standpoint of view, that shows us again how you might have done it. And again, it shows us your greatness and the power that is in your hand. Thank you, Lord, for the gospel. Thank you, Lord, for the salvation in Christ. Thank you, Lord, for this local church that stands for it. And we stand for truth wherever it is found. And Lord, we find it in the Word. And where we find it in the natural sciences, too, we understand that also is part of your law, part of your written information in physical evidence. So thank you, Lynn, for the evening together. Bless us. We go home to bring us back again. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.